I agree. House will come to order. Please stand as we have the color guard post the Department of Corrections honor guard, led by Captain John Whitney, guest of Representative Jensen.
Post. Ready? Two. Present. Armed.
Representative Hicks will lead the pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Order. Armed. About face. Post. Shoulder. Armed. Or march.
Opening ceremony will be presented by Wendell B. Barnett, Salem, a guest of Andy Olson.
Join me in a moment of quiet. Father in heaven, these are busy days. There are many voices that clamor for our attention and many pressures upon the members of this body. Somehow, in the midst of all these things, may we develop the ability to quiet our hearts and hear your voice, which points in the way of wisdom and truth and understanding and compassion. Give us listening ears not only to hear your voice, but to hear those words from our associates, those who debate with us, in this process of formulating laws in this state. Thank you for the service of each one. Thank you for their sacrifice of time. I pray for families, for every staff member here, that you will give to each your strength, that you will encourage them. And as we move through this day, may we be cognizant of your presence, always with us, always guiding us. And I thank you in the name of Jesus. Amen.
Courtesies, Representative Olson.
Mr. Speaker, colleagues and audience, Wendell Barnett and his wife Donita have been married for 47 years. They have 3 children and 10 grandchildren. If you have, if he looks familiar to you, it's because he's been here in the Capitol since 2001, coming to the Capitol to encourage all of us at times through prayer and just being there for elected officials. Wendell has been involved in the ministry since 1968. He has served in the pastorate in the state of Texas, in Kansas, where in 1972 he was the House chaplain, a correction, in 1973, and also served as in a pastorate here in Oregon. I'd like to thank Wendell for his hard work and dedication in serving us and others, and welcome him.
For the courtesies, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I would like for you to extend courtesies to the Corrections Honor Guard who were so happy to be with us this morning to present the colors for us. The Corrections Honor Guard is led by Captain John Whitney. And members are Sergeant Ron Hublitz, Sergeant Anthony Rubicaba, Corporal Joseph Laro, and CO Mary Laker. Colleagues, this honor guard is here this morning to help us remember one of their fallen colleagues that we will be addressing in House Concurrent Resolution 206 in just a few moments. So welcome to this honor guard that we're here with us this morning as they've come to pay their respects to their fallen comrade too. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you for being here today with all of us. Representative Krieger, for the courtesies.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I ask that you extend courtesies to all the members of the Camas Valley 2011 A1 Championship football team. They're up in the balcony. They are here today with their school superintendent, Mr. Gallagher. Their coach, Eli Wolf, could not be here today. They had a perfect 14-0 record this year. They also set a national record for points scored in the entire nation. And this is the 5th title for the Camas Valley School, which is, I don't know of a school that has more than that. Coach Wolf was also named as A1 Coach of the Year for the entire state. And Camas Valley is an example of a small area, small community, shows what you can achieve when you have a dedicated coach, staff, school, and community. Again, I thank you for being here with us today, and please enjoy your time at the Capitol.
Thank you for being here. We really appreciate the long drive you made, especially those of us who have that similar drive. And for those of you who don't know, it's near the larger town of Remote here in Oregon. Actually, it's the big town that Remote can go visit. So thank you for being here, and congratulations on those amazing events. Further courtesies, Representative Doherty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I actually have 2 courtesies today. I would like to introduce and thank Max Slider, who's been my intern from the University of Oregon. He's a junior majoring in political science and Spanish. And not only that, but he is also a graduate of Tigard High School. Thanks to Max. My second courtesy, if you look over on that, whatever is at the South Gallery, I'd like to introduce Dominic S., who is an exchange student from Zurich, Switzerland, and he has currently been here at Wilson High School, which is my alma mater, all year long, and he goes back in July. Listen, remember this gentleman's and this young man's name, Dominic S., because someday he will be part of the Swiss Federal Council. You know, Switzerland has a seven-person governing board. He will be on it someday. He came over here last summer. He has already worked political campaigns. He has done phone banking, and he has knocked on doors. So I would like to introduce Dominic and welcome him to the Capitol, and if you will do the same. Thank you much.
Further courtesies, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I'd like to ask you to extend some courtesies to some friends of mine from Central Oregon on the South Isle. Dan Polish, stand up, Dan. Good morning. He is sales manager at Polish Homes and president of the Central Oregon Builders Association. Mike O'Neill. Mike is founded Solar Air to provide home buyers with efficiency, energy efficiency, passive and active solar residential home products. And Daniel Rostin, stand up, past president of Central Oregon Business Builders Association. They're here to be sure that we create jobs so they can build some homes for them. Welcome to your capital.
Thank you for coming and visiting, and I want to thank Representative Wisnett. There's a group up above as well who I believe are from Lowell. There are some students. You can wave if that's the group on a historic tour. I don't know if that's the right group or not. Yeah, it says A. Lowell. Ah, Three Sisters. Aha. You are the Three Sisters Adventist Christian from Bend. Thank you for standing up, and thanks that we got to make that announcement. Further courtesy is Representative Hicks.
Seated in the South Gallery are four very active Oregonians. Bob Stumbo, Dennis Dixon, and Les and Carol Berg are here to put a human face on Oregon's mining industry. Please extend them your welcome.
Further courtesies, Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Colleagues, as one of the moms with young school children in the building, my favorite visitors to the Capitol are school children. And today I have a group from Bolton Primary who's here today. And they're up there in the gallery. There's a group of them just getting seated. So if you could extend your courtesies to the kids from Bolton, I'd appreciate it. And welcome to your Capitol.
Good morning and welcome to your Capitol. Hope you enjoy the day. Further courtesies? Verification of the quorum. Clerk will open the voting system to verify the presence of a quorum. Representative Beyer, is Representative Beyer present? Quorum is present. Messages from the governor, messages from the Senate.
Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the President to inform you the Senate has passed House Bills 4013, 4015, 4128, and adopted HCR 203.
First readings, memorials, and resolutions. Standing committee reports. The committee report file has been distributed. Special committee reports, special orders of business. The clerk shall read the resolution.
SCR 206, in memoriam, Officer Buddy Ray Heron, 1969 to 2011.
Before I introduce the bill, I would just like to make sure that people recognize, keep it quiet and let the presentation go. As we honor this recipient. So, question now arises upon final reading and adoption of HCR 206. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the resolution, whereas Officer Buddy Ray Heron was born August 25th, 1969, and killed on November 28th, 2011. Whereas Officer Buddy Ray Heron was born in Chicago, Illinois, and whereas Officer Buddy Ray Heron attended Tolson High School in Arizona, and whereas Officer Buddy Ray Heron joined the United States Navy in 1988 and was honorably discharged in 1996, and whereas in 1990, Officer Buddy Ray Heron married Kim Reeves, the love of his life, and was the father of James, Joshua, Jacob, and Jenna. And whereas Officer Buddy Ray Heron began his career as a correctional officer with the Arizona Department of Corrections in 1999. And whereas Officer Buddy Ray Heron moved to Helix, Oregon, and went to work with the Department of Corrections in 2007, working at Eastern Oregon Correctional Institution. And whereas on November 28, 2011, Officer Buddy Ray Heron stopped to assist a stranded motorist on his way to work. And whereas Officer Buddy Ray Heron was then tragically killed while providing that assistance and in the performance of his duties as a public safety officer. And whereas Officer Buddy Ray Heron was a hardworking correctional officer with the Department of Corrections, a loving and royal family man, and a wonderful father and husband. And whereas Officer Buddy Ray Heron's greatest joys were his wife and children. And whereas Officer Buddy Ray Heron was able to fix anything broken or in disrepair, had an incredible sense of humor, and was active with his local Church of Latter-day Saints. And whereas in his spare time, Officer Buddy Ray Heron volunteered with his local fire department district. And whereas Officer Buddy Ray Heron especially enjoyed activities with his family and camping at their favorite spots on the north rim of the Grand Canyon. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the Legislative Assembly of the State of Oregon that we, the members of the 76th Legislative Assembly, honor and express our appreciation for Officer Buddy Ray Heron and his service to the residents of the State of Oregon, and be it further resolved that a copy of this resolution be presented with our condolences to Officer Buddy Ray Heron's family. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion? He doesn't want to do it.
Yes.
Seeing none, Representative Jensen, do you wish to close?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yes, just very, very briefly. Officer Heron was murdered. As stated in the resolution, by stopping to help. Stopping to help a person that obviously didn't deserve that stop. However, his wife, who unfortunately, for a number of reasons, was unable to be here with the family today, but his wife left us a thought as far as Buddy was concerned, and I quote, "Buddy, in his memory, would never want for people now not to stop to help a stranger."
Those who are of the opinion that the resolution should be adopted will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. I believe there are a number of people from the Oregon Corrections up in the gallery. If they want to stand, we'd like to recognize them as well for being here today, as well as our honor guard. Thank you for being here, and thank you for your assistance in keeping our state safe. HCR 206, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Propositions and motions. Representative Wisnett.
Mr. Speaker and honorable colleagues, I bring you today from your House Transportation and Economic Development Committee, Senate Bill 1544.
Ask for the motion first. Sorry about this. That was my fault.
Mr. Speaker, I move adoption of the committee report on Senate Bill 1544.
Representative Misnett moves adoption of the committee report of Senate Bill 1544. To your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Got ahead of us there. Colleagues, I do bring you today House Transportation Economic Development Committee Senate Bill 1544A. Senate Bill 1544A is a Senate committee bill which was passed the Senate 29-0. Your House committee moved the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. This bipartisan bill represents the opportunity to bring 465 contiguous acres of industrial land into the state inventory for economic developments and job creation opportunities in an area that has some of the highest unemployment in the state. I urge your yes vote to provide a significant opportunity for jobs and economic development.
Representative Hunt.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the minority report on Senate Bill 1544 be substituted for the committee report.
Representative Hunt moves the minority report on Senate Bill 1544 be substituted for the committee report. To your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker and colleagues. We've got an opportunity today to pass the jobs bill. We've talked a lot about jobs in this session. It's important to note that this bill includes several components. It does include the base bill that my colleague from rural Deschutes County just mentioned that will allow in the future a particular parcel of industrial land in Redmond to be able to move forward. As he said, that provision enjoys broad bipartisan support and will eventually create jobs in the Redmond area. But the minority report does that and then goes much further to make sure that we create jobs not just in Redmond, not just in Central Oregon, but that we create jobs all over our state. The minority report says that we shouldn't just create jobs in the future when that land will eventually be brought in, but that we should create jobs this biennium. And we should do it in three particular areas. One, investing in Connect Oregon, something that has enjoyed broad bipartisan support in this House since 2005. Making critical investments in rail and marine and aviation, multimodal transportation to reduce congestion and improve freight mobility. Good for businesses, good for jobs all across our state. You are probably aware that the Connect Oregon 4 selection process is right in the middle of happening right now, and this money, this $10 million in this minority report can be plugged right in to that process. No additional process is needed, and if you've looked at the list of those 70 projects, it will fund good projects that are ready to go, but the funding isn't there to fund them this biennium. Next, it will add $10 million to the Special Public Works Fund. Again, an existing fund that doesn't require any new infrastructure or bureaucracy. It's an existing fund that focuses specifically on helping fund critical sewer and water infrastructure projects across our state. If you've talked to your communities, and this is probably disproportionately true in smaller, more rural communities, they're under huge federal mandates right now to comply with federal clean water provisions. And they do not have the money to be able to do those projects. This will put $10 million into the Special Public Works Fund to serve as a low-interest revolving loan fund to be able to fund those sewer and water infrastructure projects. Good for jobs all across our state, and also good for clean water. Finally, this bill puts $9.6 million into community college capital construction. And I hope you've looked at the list of projects that will be funded by this, because there is one of them serving every single one in our districts. Ironically, there happens to be one in Redmond. So this bill is a double win. This minority report is a double win for Redmond, because it funds not only, it approves not only the industrial land, but also funds a specific workforce development project in Redmond, as well as 16 other projects. They're all capital projects. They're all going to outlive the life of the bond. They're all going to be critical investments to make sure that the businesses that need a better trained workforce in the future have access to that workforce through these facilities. So this is really a win. This minority report is a win in four different ways. You get the win of the long-term benefit to industrial lands in Redmond. You get the win of critical investments now in Connect Oregon. You get the win of critical investments now in the infrastructure for sewer and water. And you get the win now of critical investments in terms of community college capital construction. These infrastructure investments, as my colleague from Rural Deschutes County noted about the other part of the bill, these infrastructure investments also enjoy broad bipartisan support. They also passed unanimously out of the Transportation Economic Development Committee, but now, unfortunately, have been bottled up in ways and means. The only path to approving these critical projects this session is this minority report. There's not going to be a second day, a second chance, a second opportunity. This is the one and only opportunity to create those jobs, to seize that opportunity for economic development this biennium, right now. There's been a lot of talk about the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission. And if you haven't read the whole report, I would urge you to read it. It is scintillating reading. You have a handout on your desk that quotes from a few pages within it, but the handout you have skips over one critical provision that's right at the beginning on page 3, where the Debt Policy Advisory Commission says very clearly, I think, the commission acknowledges that capital projects funded by lottery-backed bonds are extremely important to Oregon's long-term economic health. We recommend that decision makers minimize the authorization of any lottery bonds during the 11-13 biennium to only the most critical economic development projects and priorities of the state. Limit lottery bonds to only the most critical economic development projects and priorities of the state. You also have on your desk a letter from the chair of the Debt Policy Advisory Committee, our state treasurer, Ted Wheeler, which again says very explicitly, Treasurer Wheeler says, I want to be clear in stating that the approximately $30 million in bonding planned via House Bill 4028, which is the base of this bill, remains within the prudent debt limits established by the State Debt Policy Advisory Committee. Treasurer Wheeler goes on to say, while I admire the abundance of caution, we would expect no less from our treasurer than admiring the abundance of caution. He says, I am supportive of the focused use of these resources on high priority economic development projects, which if monitored carefully will be a sensible move. Hopefully any questions you have from the findings of the Debt Policy Advisory Committee are asked and answered by both the report and Treasurer Wheeler's follow-up letter. So it's clear we've got additional bonding capacity. We actually have $50 million of additional lottery bonding capacity. This bill only authorizes just less than 30. It's also clear that these economic development projects are exactly the priorities for which the lottery was originally authorized. Now, we could probably spend days or weeks debating whether or not the lottery should have been formed in the first place, or whether it should be curtailed now, or the fact that it's regressive in its nature. Had I been around when the lottery was created, I would have voted no. I'd be right there with those arguments. But nothing in this bill is going to determine whether or not we have a lottery. Nothing in this bill is going to determine the regressive nature of the lottery. Nothing in this bill is going to determine whether or not the lottery raises money. This is only going to determine whether there is an actual upside to the lottery. So we've got all the downside. That's already locked in. Will we have an upside in terms of job creation and economic development across our state? This is the perfect time to bond and build. If there was ever a time to bond and build, this is it. When are we ever going to have low interest rates to borrow, low construction costs to build, and a workforce and construction-related businesses that are hungry and ready to do this work this biennium? So colleagues, this minority report vote presents a clear choice. On the one hand, if we want to create short-term construction jobs all across Oregon, as well as long-term better freight mobility, cleaner water, better workforce preparation for our businesses, and employment land in Redmond, then we should vote yes. If we only want to create employment land in the long-term in Redmond, then vote no. On behalf of the thousands of unemployed and underemployed construction workers across our state, I urge your yes vote. On behalf of the hundreds of construction-related businesses who are hungry for this work now, I urge your yes vote. On behalf of all 17 community colleges who are hungry for the workforce development investments that this minority report will bring, I urge your yes vote. On behalf of the communities that need these sewer and water infrastructure projects because the federal government is hammering them for compliance, I urge your yes vote to give them these tools. And on behalf of the businesses and communities that need access to better freight mobility to be able to move their product to and from the marketplace, I urge your yes vote. In closing, I just say, colleagues, I'd encourage us all to think about what we've said. What have we said in remonstrances on this floor? What have we said in committee about jobs? What have we said in our press releases? I've certainly said them in mine. What have we said in our town meetings? What have we said in our newsletters? What have we pledged to constituents about this session that we're going to do, that we're going to vote, that we're going to act to create jobs? This minority report is the time to match our rhetoric, and we're good at rhetoric, colleagues, to match our rhetoric with actual results. This minority report is the time for us to walk our talk. I urge you to vote yes to create good construction jobs all over Oregon and get all the other benefits in this minority report, and to do it this biennium.
Further discussion, Representative Jefferson Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the motion.
To the motion.
Mr. Speaker, I rise also to support the minority report and that ask that it be inserted in lieu of the base bill. I want to applaud the good representative who just spoke for the jobs benefits of the bill, and I want to add two additional benefits. We need to clarify an error in the underlying bill. Page 2, Section 1, Sub 3A lists criteria that should be used to determine the zoning changes that can go forward without determining whether the change will have a significant effect on existing or planned transportation facilities if the designated activities meet certain criteria. This is going to sound technical, but it's actually important. People testified that they meant those to be multiple criteria, but the only printed modifier is an or. This is a small word error, but it is not a small meaning error. It means the exception is okay as long as the proposal is necessary to support the planned employment use and not large-scale commercial and containing overall trips. But if any of those things are true, anything that is not large-scale commercial, anything that helps contain overall trips, even if it's not necessary to support employment uses, anything, even if it is a large-scale commercial and does nothing to contain overall trips and is not even part of the employment plan. The bill as printed doesn't seem to make sense, or if it does make sense, does error and does damage to the intent, the stated intent of the bill. I would hope that we would vote yes for the minority report to clarify that error. The intent of the bill in the legislative record was clarified. The testifier, multiple testifiers said, oh yeah, it was supposed to be multiple, not merely alternative criteria. But spoken intent in legislative history often doesn't trump the written words on the page. I hope we will vote yes on the minority report to clarify the bill. Second, let's add some transparency. In the bill, we have reporting requirements for community colleges. The minority report would add similar language for Class 1 railroads. We have had some questions about the recent press reports of $27 million in Connect Oregon grants, not loans, to an out-of-state company that made $13 billion last year. This would not prohibit Connect Oregon from making such grants. Some of those investments certainly can be justified. But it would merely ask that we get good information about the jobs created from those projects and the return on our investment. We as a legislature don't typically get such reports from such projects. And when talking to members of Ways and Means, they're unaware that we are even doing these grants as distinct from loans, because these projects go through the Transportation Commission and do not typically get similar scrutiny from Ways and Means or elsewhere in this elected body. These are real and important changes and should be consensus changes. I urge to vote yes to add transparency. And third, some may argue that we should never be doing bonding for projects. We should not be doing bonding for projects at all this year. I don't share that view. I agree that we should be careful about borrowing, but we should borrow for good investment-grade investments. In my personal life, my wife and I don't borrow to buy a car. We do borrow to buy a house. We should be willing, particularly when money is cheap, particularly when people are unemployed, particularly when infrastructure is needed, to borrow money to take advantage of those opportunities and alleviate some of those challenges. This is not borrowing to buy a car. This is borrowing to buy a house. These are smart infrastructure investments. We should make them. I urge your yes vote for the minority report, for jobs, for investment, for transparency, and for a clarified bill. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion, Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the motion.
To the motion.
Thank you. I very much support this motion and minority report and the underlying bill, and I'm grateful for all of them, and I hope you all join me in voting yes. But let's just face it. If this is the best we can do, we're creating jobs in this state this month, well, that's a big, big, big disappointment to the working families and their children in this state who need a job. My friends from Albany and District 55 have done everything they can respective to timber and water, and I hope they're successful. But if we fail, we're failing the thousands of workers out there that just want a job. The best thing, we talk about funding education, health care, and safety, great. The best thing we can do for children and the vulnerable in this state is make sure their families have a job. Their parents have a job, they can send those children to school, fed, clean, prepared to learn. This bill is a good bill, but it is a drop in the bucket. It is a grain of sand in the desert. It is a single dim star in the infinite heavens. And I'm telling you, we're just not, if this is all we're gonna go leave this building, no one should be proud of our job creation efforts in this building if this is all we have to take home. No one should be proud of that. I urge your vote.
Further discussion, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the motion.
To the motion.
Colleagues, I rise because I think there is a significant misunderstanding about the situation that we face in connection with our debt policy and our debt situation, and I want to clarify it this morning. I spoke about it briefly yesterday under remonstrances, and I note that there is a floor letter from the member from Oregon's Timber Capital on the subject before you today, two-page letter. I commend it to you. I think you ought to read it. There is a misunderstanding, I believe, in this letter that I would like to clarify and that I think is important. I would note the very last sentence in the first paragraph in which it states, this is particularly troubling considering that both the general fund and lottery fund revenues are declining. Colleagues, general fund and lottery revenues are not declining. They are increasing. The misunderstanding comes because we confuse the revenue estimates that show projections for future revenues with actual revenues. Actual revenues have been increasing for some time. This morning I talked with Legislative Revenue Office so I could get the numbers accurately. General fund revenues were up in 9/11 by 7.6%, not down. We expect revenues to be up this biennium, 11/13, by 9.9%, nearly 10%. Now, of course, this is partly a projection because the biennium isn't over yet, but that's a projection after all the declines in the revenue estimates that we have been receiving. We expect the lottery revenues did indeed decline in 9/11, but we expect them to be up slightly in 11/13. Essentially, they're flat. Colleagues, why is this distinction important? It's critically important because it's important for us to understand that we are not in a free fall situation. We're not in a situation in which we are mortgaging a future with lower and lower revenues in which to support these critical investments that we're talking about in this minority report. The fact is our revenues are increasing. They're simply not as increasing as quickly as expected in the revenue estimates. Now, why is that an important consideration? There's a couple of additional things you need to know about why that's important. The first most important one is that if you've been following revenue estimates, you also know the revenue estimates are always too high during declining times. That is, the revenue, the state economist is always too optimistic. Things actually are not going to recover as quickly as he estimated. The other thing you need to know is that during up times, the revenue estimates are always, always, always too low. That is, he's always too pessimistic about the rate of growth. There's a number of reasons that are connected with that. Colleagues, I want to point out that in the United States today, industrial production is within 5% of what it was at the bottom of the recession. It's climbing. Shifting towards goods production is good for Oregon because Oregon is a manufacturing state. And the fact is that Oregon should recover more quickly than the rest of the nation does from the recession, which technically, according to the economists, ended a couple of years ago. This is important for this bill. No one should vote against this motion because they believe that we can't afford it. The Treasurer has said, as quoted by a good representative from Clackamas County, that we can. And in fact, on those critical measures, again, quoting from the report, the highest priority state capital projects are the ones that we ought to be considering. And those, colleagues, are the ones in this minority report. The reality is that our revenues are increasing. They are not decreasing. They are not declining. And we will have the funds necessary to pay our bills and to pay for the bond investments that we are making if this measure passes. We also need to recognize that the passage of the measure itself will increase our revenues. One quick example, Coburg has been in a building freeze for a long time because of sewer and water problems. They have broken ground on their sewer plant. I am very pleased with that. They will have the prospect of growth. They will have the prospect of increased jobs. They will have the prospects in Coburg of increased revenues to help pay for these bonds and for the other things that we're dealing with. Ditto, same comment applies to community college, building funding. Classes are full. There's not enough space for additional classes. Colleagues, better educated students do a better job of paying taxes. And I'm finished. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hanna, co-speaker, Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the motion.
To the motion.
Colleagues, we're having an interesting discussion this morning. And it's interesting that a number of the speakers have referenced the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission report. And I can assure you I have read it inside and out. It's also interesting to me that at least two of the speakers, in regards to lottery or whether or not lottery bonding is appropriate at this time, failed to mention that the true capacity to issue lottery bonds is based primarily on prudent management and sound fiscal practice. Comes from the book, not from me, comes from the book. But nobody has said that yet today. Nobody is standing up for Oregonians saying, we sent you here to pay particularly close attention to the dollars we send you and the way you use them. And I am sure indebtedness ranks high with them. I'm going to read a section here from this book. The Oregon Constitution requires the Legislative Assembly to appropriate unobligated net lottery proceeds or revenues to first repay lottery bonds before appropriating the proceeds for any other purpose. So what are the purposes? Well, once lottery-backed debt service is paid, that's number one. By the way, 25% of every dollar into lottery goes to debt service. That's the first obligation. Once lottery-backed debt is paid each year, the remaining state lottery funds are distributed to the Education Stability Fund. Everybody clearly hear that? To the Education Stability Fund, the Parks and Natural Resources Fund as required by the Constitution, and then allocated and applied to certain economic development and educational purposes. So how much will we take away from the Education Stability Fund when we continue to borrow and obligate the proceeds, unobligated proceeds of lottery funds when we do this again? Well, let's answer that. The Education Stability Fund and the Parks and Natural Resource Fund are allocated 18% and 15% respectively of unobligated net proceeds. So the more we obligate ourselves to debt, the less we put into those two funds. So you got to think to yourself, do we want to take away from that Education Stability Fund? Pretty important. Do we want to take away from our ability to do other economic development projects as may be prescribed in lottery? Or do we want to obligate ourselves to debt for which I believe we are currently exceeding the limitation? So let's talk about what is the limitation for debt using prudent management and sound fiscal position. Let's talk about that. The Commission's lottery bond capacity policy is that existing and proposed lottery debt service not exceed 4x coverage or no more than 25% of net unobligated lottery revenue. Now, we've had two other speakers reference the book and talk about what is that. And I'm grateful to the speaker from Clackamas County because he actually pointed out a second place, which he didn't mention, but it's on page 3, where the book clearly lays out the fact that 2012 and 2013, when you look at annual amount of additional debt that may be issued and remain within authorized debt coverage ratios, is blank. It is zero. It is none. The commission who wrote the report didn't put we might have $50 million in here. They didn't put we might have $30 million in here. They put zero. That's on page 36 of the book. Take a peek. It's also on page 3 of the book, which says, we said no. The question here this morning is, do we go beyond that? How much more do we do? The speaker from Central Lane and Linn counties talked about some of the capacity issues and whether or not we were up or down and used some semantics, but let me read directly from the book. Given the substantial reduction in lottery projected revenue, or how about using the treasurer's own letter, which has been referenced?
Representative Wingert yields.
Thank you, Representative. Which we heard a little bit different take on, but the treasurer's letter of February 17th says, my staff has updated lottery debt capacity using the latest lottery revenue forecast. So let's see, what did I just read? Given the substantial reduction in lottery projected revenue, then take the letter from the treasurer which says, although it dropped by another 1.9% over the six-year horizon, you can't find a place in this book that will tell you lottery revenue is on the rise. And colleagues, I'm here to tell you that that debt capacity we are exceeding today, we don't have to borrow a penny more in lottery, and we will further exceed it if revenue falls. You can all do that math, right? You don't have to borrow one more dime in lottery funding. If lottery revenue continues to fall, the capacity to borrow money shrinks and pushes us further beyond the limitation. In addition to that, there are other capacity issues. So I've talked about the issue of what's lottery revenue doing. It's clearly stated in the book. But there's also other capacity considerations and other restrictions possible. Given the state's use of lottery bonds to promote economic development activities that do not always fit into the federal government's tax rules with regard to qualified private activity, so we do both taxable and non-taxable bonding, issuance of lottery debt on a taxable basis generally results in a higher overall interest rate than the tax-exempt rates we have assumed for our capacity calculations. Here's the key point. Assuming a blended taxable tax-exempt rate, and it lists the rates, but we'll let that go, the available overall capacity for 6 years would decrease. And we could go into all the numbers. I'm standing before you as a business person, with a payroll and employees at home that I'm responsible to. I'm standing before you as someone who has brought jobs legislation to this body for which I am passionately working to make move. But I'm also standing before you on behalf of taxpayers who said to us when they elected us, I believe, to use that fiscal and prudent management. I would ask you to vote no on this minority report and give those voters and those taxpayers the confidence they should have in us to use their funds in that fiscally prudent manner. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the motion.
To the motion.
Mr. Speaker and colleagues, I'm speaking to you as a member of the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. I want to quickly describe, lay out for you the contents of this minority report in just sort of a quick, organized fashion. It contains basically four kinds of things. All had been discussed in committee. The contents of Senate Bill 1544, a slight technical fix to 1544, bonding authority adopted in House Bill 4028A, and a small addition to 4028 requiring transparency. First, the base bill, Senate Bill 1544, was heard by the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development on Thursday, February 16th. The minority report contains the entirety of that bill, which was thoroughly discussed. It's about transportation and economic development. The second part of the minority report is an issue that arose during the committee's discussion of 1544. It's about a slight technical error related to punctuation and conjunctions. Is it supposed to be an or an and? The testimony from the local advocates and others who will be applying the policy indicated that the use of the word and would be appropriate. So the technical fix is to change or to and. The third element of the minority report is about bonding for infrastructure. It's the exact content of House Bill 4028A that was heard by the committee and discussed on February 2nd and February 9th and passed out of the committee unanimously. The fourth and last element is a small piece that adds greater transparency to Connect Oregon 4 funding. That also was discussed by the committee at that time. I'd also like to add for you some information in a letter that our committee received from State Treasurer Ted Wheeler. I'm not sure whether all of you have received it, so it's very short. I'll quote, "Our Treasurer Wheeler sent the committee a letter dated February 17th, of this year. This is new information. It's the treasurer's evaluation, the treasurer's exact words. Quote, in light of the recent lottery revenue forecast, I have received several questions as to whether this affects the Treasury's stance on House Bill 4028 as amended. I want to be clear in stating that the approximately $30 million in bonding planned via House Bill 4028 remains within the prudent debt limits established by the State Debt Policy Advisory Committee. The next paragraph continues. My staff has updated the lottery debt capacity model using the latest lottery revenue forecast. Although it dropped by another 1.9% over the six-year horizon, lottery debt capacity is not significantly impacted until the next biennium and beyond by this latest forecast reduction. Of course, we will continue to monitor lottery revenue forecasts and bring to your attention any necessary adjustments as we become aware of them. While I admire the abundance of caution, I am also supportive of the focused use of these resources on high-priority economic development projects, which, if monitored carefully, will be a sensible move. So what this bill, what this minority report has, is transportation and economic development from Senate Bill 1544, transportation and economic development from House Bill 4028, and transparency and monitoring. I support the minority report. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion, Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the motion?
To the motion.
Colleagues, first I want to thank the members of the Committee of Transformation and Economic Development for passing out the committee report in a bipartisan way. That committee report came out with a bipartisan support, and I believe the committee report is what we should be discussing and working on, and I hope we get a chance to do that in a few minutes. Specifically to the discussion around the minority report, fascinating discussion about bonding, and we got a little bit of what normally goes on in the subcommittee of capital construction out here on the House floor. I do believe that is the proper place for this discussion in capital construction subcommittee, where really this very important issue can be addressed, and I would commend to you all that that committee is still open and this work could be done there where it's properly vetted and worked through the process. Today I would urge your no vote on the minority report and ask that we can get on with the business of the committee report and work on that. Thank you very much.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Hunt, do you wish to close?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Speaker. Just a few follow-up points based on the discussion. There is no question our constituents have sent us here to be both fiscally prudent and to create jobs. That is something that we can achieve both of. I mean, if we were to tell our constituents we have to choose one or the other, we can only focus on fiscal prudence or we can only focus on job creation, I think we're presenting to our constituents a completely false choice. We can do both. This minority report does both. And you know, you can slice and dice the State Debt Policy Advisory Committee a whole bunch of different ways, but it is clear, and the Treasurer's letter underscores it even further. It's not a judgment call. It's not an interpretation call. It says, focus on critical economic development projects and priorities. The Treasurer has said, these are them. Second, in terms of whether or not this bill could be heard, my preference was obviously that this bill be heard in the Capital Construction Subcommittee and passed out of Ways and Means. That is being blocked by one person right now. I don't have the ability to free that up. It's not going to be heard. We have the opportunity to pass this and actually send it over to the Senate for concurrence and actually enact these multiple job-creating benefits or not. But let's be clear, voting no on this minority report doesn't mean there's a second chance through capital construction. This is our opportunity today. And finally, colleagues, I would just remind us, since I think we've only had two minority reports during this whole biennium, these are not procedural votes. These are substantive policy choices. This is just like voting on an amendment in committee, an amendment to a bill. You have a choice between A policy or B policy. So let's be clear, this is not a procedural vote. This is a vote on the substance of this bill. Do we, A, create some long-term jobs in Redmond, period? Or B, do we vote yes on this minority report and create short-term and long-term jobs all across our state? I urge you to do the latter. I urge you to vote yes on this minority report.
Those who are of the opinion that the minority report on Senate Bill 1544 should be substituted for the committee report will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Jefferson Smith votes aye. The motion to substitute the report for the committee report on Senate Bill 1544, having not received the required majority, is declared failed. Please stand at ease. House will come to order. It's the income plan. In compliance with House Rule 9.15, subsection 2, after the motion to substitute has been decided, the bill shall be further considered on the calendar for third reading. The clerk will read the bill.
Senate Bill 1544, relating to economic development and declaring an emergency.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 1544A. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, we had some interesting debate and discussion. Senate Bill 1544A, the bill exempts the City of Redmond from statewide land use planning goal related to transportation planning and administrative rules that implement goal with respect to development of a Southeast Redmond employment site near the fairgrounds. This property was formerly zoned industrial, rezoned in the 70s as a potential site for the fairgrounds. Another site was selected for the fairgrounds. This site is located within the city limits, owned by public agencies, in close proximity to the regional commercial airport, served by sewer and water. Local officials report several companies have in recent years expressed interest in this site. Senate Bill 1544A, as proposed, is the result of a very successful collaborative effort between the cities of Redmond, Department of Land Conservation Development, ODOT, Thousand Friends of Oregon, Land Watch of Central Oregon, Economic Development of Central Oregon, the Governor's Office, and our elected officials from Redmond, from both parties. We also, the bill, as you know, was started a committee in the Senate chaired by a Democrat. This bipartisan bill represents the opportunity to bring 465 contiguous acres of industrial land into the state inventory for economic development and job creation opportunities in an area that has some of the highest unemployment in the state. Colleagues, help our district reduce the highest unemployment in the state. Help families in Oregon and in Central Oregon. I urge your yes vote to provide a significant opportunity for jobs and economic development. Thank you very much.
Further discussion? Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
This is a good bill. Should pass. I urge your vote. 465 acres of buildable land. I'm happy we're going to do that. But this is what we're going to go home with. 465 acres of buildable land. While tens of thousands of acres out there ready to burn up, we could put people to work on. While millions of acre feet go by and out into the ocean unused. You know, I'm sorry, if this is all, and you can spin it any way you want with all those other little policy bills, you can spin it any way you want. If this is all we can do, we are failing the working families of this state and their children. This is not a proud day to be an Oregonian or to stand here on this floor with you. We're failing. Good bill should pass. Urge your vote.
Further discussion. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
This bill is a sensible solution to a specific problem in one very specific location. It was really encouraging to see coming to the table land use advocates, community boosters, economic development professionals, and others all agreeing to a solution. I support that. I think it's terrific. I do want to reiterate, however, what I heard during the committee hearing, what I heard from testimony from those proponents and community boosters and advocates on the issue of the and or the or that has turned out to be potentially significant. When we asked specifically what was meant by that phrase, those criteria that needed to be met, what I heard and what I saw from heads nodding in the affirmative up and down was that the use of and would be appropriate and satisfactory, and they agreed to it, and I just wanted that to be on the record. Other than that, I'm very happy. I hope that we can help this community move along, get them the jobs and economic development that they have want and worked for so many years. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Smith. Jefferson Smith, sorry about that.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
So I appreciate the good representative from Eugene's comments.
And to clarify, I was a no vote in committee, and given the clarification that the good representative offered, I'm prepared to vote yes on the floor. And just so that we're clear, under 3AA, Section 1, Sub 3A, where it says the city shall adopt a zoning designation or zoning overlay that restricts retail commercial activities allowed on the site to activities that, A, are necessary to support the planned employment uses, and then there is no modifier, and it's followed by two things, are not large-scale retail commercial, or help contain overall trips. That or can be appropriate. What's necessary to read the bill is understand the modifier after employment uses in 1-3-AA is there should be an and there to make it clear it needs to be necessary to support the planned employment uses, not anything that's not part of the planned employment uses, not anything that contains overall trips, or not anything that isn't a large-scale retail commercial activity. It also needs to be necessary to support the planned employment uses. And with that clarification in the legislative record on intent, I will be voting yes.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Wisnant, do you wish to close?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Again, good comments. This bill, I want to point out that there's no names on this bill. This bill came from the Senate committee. It's chaired by a Democrat. It's a good bill. It will create jobs. The issues that were discussed were talked or discussed. The people, LCDC, the state agencies, and the environmental community understood, looked at this the way it was, the way it's drafted and presented to you today. Please vote yes.
Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Senate Bill 1544A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. First reading of House bills. Second reading of House bills.
House Bill 4167 relating to offenses and declaring an emergency. House Bill 4168 relating to courts and declaring an emergency. House Bill 4169 relating to offenses and declaring an emergency. House Bill 4170 relating to dog training and prescribing an effective date.
Bills read the second time are passed a third reading. Third reading of House bills. Final reading, memorials and resolutions. Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and that SCR 205 be taken from today's calendar and placed in its proper place on Friday, February 24th, 2012 calendar. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Bills, reports, and other business lying on the table. First reading of Senate bills. Second reading of Senate bills.
Senate Bill 1546 related to trees. Senate Bill 1561 related to the Oregon Military Department and prescribing an effective date.
Bills read the second time are passed a third reading. Third reading of Senate bills. The clerk will read the bill.
Senate Bill 1580 relating to health care delivery and declaring an emergency.
Question now arises upon third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 1580A. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Before I get started, I'd like to declare a potential conflict of interest.
State your conflict.
My family owns a business that could possibly do business with future coordinated care organizations, and my wife currently works for a managed care organization.
So noted for the record.
Thank you.
Proceed.
So first, I'd like to thank a few folks that were involved in the Senate Bill 1580 project for their hard work and extensive amount of time helping to get this bill completed correctly. So I want to thank representatives, and I know I'm not supposed to say names, so you can yell at me when I get done, Thompson, Kotek, Kenemer, Conger, and Greenlick. And I'd like to thank Senators Bates, Cruz, Morris, and Montes Anderson. I'd like to thank the governor and his office. And I'd like to thank Dr. Goldberg and the Oregon Health Authority. I'd like to thank all the stakeholder groups, and trust me, there's a whole bunch of them, for their input and their help getting to the point we are. And I'd like to thank a few of the lobbyists. And most importantly, the Oregon taxpayers, because they're paying for this health care delivery system that we're creating. And we need never to forget that we don't get to do any of this without the Oregon taxpayers paying their taxes so that we can do this program. So what I want to start with is what this bill is not. I know that's sort of a negative way to start, but I want everybody to understand what this bill does not do. Senate Bill 1580 does not change anything about how private health insurance or private health care is delivered. Senate Bill 1580 is not a health care mandate. In fact, there are no mandates included in Senate Bill 1580 at all. Senate Bill 1580 does not require any health care provider to provide services to Oregon health care plan patients. Senate Bill 1580 does not affect anyone other than those citizens receiving benefits from the Oregon Health Plan and health care providers that choose to provide care to Oregon Health Care Plan recipients. So now let's talk about what it is and what it does. First, I want everybody to clearly hear that Senate Bill 1580 is a better way to deliver taxpayer-funded health care services the state is already paying for. We're already doing this. The Oregon Health Care Plan has been going a long time. Senate Bill 1580 is an important bill that provides the framework to coordinate the major components of the Oregon Health Care Plan. These include, but are not limited to, physical, mental, behavior, and oral health care delivered to Oregon Health Care Plan recipients. Senate Bill 1580 does increase local community involvement, local control, and local decision making in how our public health care dollars are spent to service recipients of the Oregon Health Care Plan. Senate Bill 1580 does increase transparency in the use of taxpayer dollars by requiring the Oregon Health Authority to develop a baseline base on the current cost per Oregon Health Care Plan recipient and report on those costs moving forward. Community care organizations will be responsible for coordinating Oregon Health Plan services and care management of Oregon Health Care Plan recipients within a fixed budget. Senate Bill 1580 does expand local flexibility and the use of taxpayer dollars for health care services in order to provide targeted community care more efficiently. I want to make clear on the record that the legislative intent is not to preclude a 501c3 organization that brings together providers of Oregon health care and consumers in a meaningful way to be certified as a CCO. Many communities around the state are already leading the charge to create better coordinated care. In my home district of Douglas County, the first step to forming a CCO has already occurred. The community members and providers came together on their own to figure out how to provide better care for less money. They've spent the last year and a half developing a plan. It is absolutely vital that we pass Senate Bill 1580 so that they and other communities where you're from, can take the next step in implementing all of this hard work. What does Senate Bill 1580 do so differently from House Bill 3650 that we passed last legislative session? Senate Bill 1580 places critical sideboards on the Oregon Health Authority as to how they will move forward with the implementation of coordinated care organizations. In Senate Bill 1580, there's a list of things that it does. Number one, it provides greater transparency in reporting and detailed by Senator Morris. Currently, your managed care organization files a report and they're audited regularly. These requirements will be carried forward to all whom participate. It also protects those forming CCOs to meet and discuss processes without violating antitrust laws. Number three, it maintains current reimbursement structures passed into law during the 2011 session, such as the PAR and non-PAR rule, and creates an arbitration process to address problem areas. House Bill 3650 set up an arbitration process for a specific situation that might occur when a health care entity and a potential coordinated care organization are not able to reach contractual terms, but the entity is necessary for the CCO to be certified. A group of stakeholders worked to develop a dispute resolution process as required by House Bill 3650. The Oregon Health Authority will be adopting rules to implement this arbitration process. During the arbitration, the parties will have an opportunity to explain how CCO's contract offers is reasonable or unreasonable. The arbitration will determine whether these decisions to not contract are reasonable or unreasonable. However, the goal is for parties to reach agreement themselves and keep the state out of it. If the party cannot agree, this would result in a non-contractual arrangement between CCOs and the entity, and the current statutes regarding par, non-par reimbursement rates will apply. If the CCO made a reasonable attempt to contract, this would not preclude the Oregon Health Authority from certifying a CCO. The fourth thing that it directly does is it allows for more than one CCO in a community if the physical provider community is not well represented or excluded from the governance. Frankly, colleagues, this is aimed primarily at the Portland area because they simply haven't been inclusive as they could be in all their deliberations and development. But statewide, we do need to protect patient-provider relationships as much as possible. So this helps the entire state. Number five, it outlines the requirements to manage risk within a CCO by maintaining the current process, which has worked well within managed care contracting. It creates a process where metrics for evaluation will be developed. This bill addresses the global budget discussion as required in House Bill 3650. It also outlines the makeup and the role of the Community Advisory Council, which is very important to the work that they'll be doing. It provides a structure to the governance requirement that ensures participation of providers within the governance structure. And it also requires within the governance structure that there's community members, so there's community buy-in. It identifies innovator agents in order to streamline communication between the state, the Oregon Health Authority, and community care organizations. It establishes a need for experience in the CCOs that those who have successfully served Oregonians with the current system can, if they so desire, become a CCO as long as they meet the other requirements under law. We established a clear method to examine the cost of defensive medicine and bring recommendations back to the 2013 legislature. And finally, for Oregon Science Health University, we added language and specific to potential funding streams which may enhance their process. In the late 1980s, the Oregon legislature passed legislation leading to the development of the Oregon Healthcare Plan. House Bill 3650 and Senate Bill 1580 are the evolution of this program. On your desk, you'll see there's eight letters of support from many of the groups that helped us with this, and there's a whole lot of other groups that didn't write letters that are very anxious for this bill to pass. So colleagues, what is Senate Bill 1580? In the words of the great representative from Happy Valley, it's a good bill, should pass. I urge your aye vote. Thank you.
Co-carrier, Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. First off, I'd like to echo the thank yous from my co-carrier for the hundreds of Oregonians who have put hours and hours into working, not only at the beginning of last session to form House Bill 3650, but to continue the work when we adjourned in June to make this bill, make sure the details were really what they needed to be. And that's what you see in Senate Bill 1580. And I think there's been a tremendous amount of work going into this bill. I think it's really a model of how to do major reform of community input and public process and an implementation bill that then does come back to the legislature for green lighting. That's what this bill does. It says the work we did in House Bill 3650 with the additional sideboards moves us forward to integrating and providing even better quality care in the Oregon Health Plan. I also want to thank my co-carrier who has embraced this bill and has spent many hours himself personally with me in my office trying to figure out how to get this right. And I think it's a model of bipartisanship on an issue that really matters to the entire state. And I'm very pleased that we have this bill on the floor today. So two things. I've mentioned that the one reason we need this bill is to say House Bill 3650, which we passed by a very large vote last session, was the right way to go, and that we need to move forward at the beginning of July 1st, taking applications from organizations who want to be coordinated care organizations to integrate care for the hundreds of Oregonians who are served by the Oregon Health Plan. So this is an approval of what we have done and where we are going. But it's also about money. And even if we didn't have a fiscal crisis, I would hope we would have done this work. But let's be honest, it was the budgetary challenges that forced this conversation. This is a critical piece of our budget in terms of the amount of savings we are hoping to achieve, not only in the remainder of this biennium, but in future biennium. This is about bending the cost curve. And since I've been in this legislature, we've been talking a lot about it. And I think finally we have really gotten serious about it. And there was a report that was issued to talk about the estimated savings in Medicaid due to the transformation that we are continuing with this bill. And in the rest, in the remainder of this biennium, we could save up to $155 million to $300 million in this biennium by going this path. But it's even more important in 2013-15, when the range is anywhere from $869 million to $1.54 billion in savings that we can reinvest in our schools and other services here in the state. By 2017-19, the estimates that we have seen say we could save up to $4.6 billion per biennium in healthcare costs by doing what we're doing today and setting us down the path to better integrated care. So it is about money. But it's also about quality, and while this does only directly affect at this point the Oregon Health Plan, we shouldn't forget that the providers who provide care through the Oregon Health Plan are hospitals, our doctors, our nurses, our mental health providers, our dentists. They also serve us, even though we're not on the Oregon Health Plan. This is going to incentivize and provide an opportunity for better integrated care for all of our providers in this state, and we will all benefit because of that. So this is not only about costs and about quality for the Oregon Health Plan, but quality of care that we will all benefit from because it's really changing the conversation about how to provide care in the state. I've had a personal interest in oral health care since I've come into the legislature, and I just want to say a few things about oral health because I think it's, we've talked a lot about physical and mental health as being the critical pieces. Oral health, in terms of the dental care organizations, they have until 2014, under House Bill 3650 that passed last year, to be part of a coordinated care organization. I would hope we don't wait till 2014 in that regard. There are studies out there that say when an individual sees a dentist, particularly if they have a chronic disease problem such as diabetes, they actually are healthier by seeing that dentist. We know if pregnant women get the dental care they need, their baby will be healthier and will have better oral health outcomes just by serving the needs of the pregnant woman. So we know that oral health is important. I would hope that we don't sit back and wait till 2014 for all the organizations out there wanting to be coordinated care organizations to engage with the dental care providers because it is incredibly important and not just an afterthought. It's an important piece of integrated care. As my co-carrier explained in detail, this is about building on what we've done around managed care and continuing the good work.
Representative Tomei yields.
Thank you, Representative. But taking it to the next level. And I think we've tried to put safeguards in there to say we appreciate the work our managed care plans have done, but it's time to go to the next level, and we just want to get it right. And one thing I would like to say also for the record is there's nothing in this bill to imply that a nonprofit organization could not be a coordinated care organization. And I think there's been some confusion on that piece, and I just wanted to clarify. And just lastly, I urge you to vote yes. Good bill should pass. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Shoffler.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Great. Thank you. The second co-carrier referred to a fiscal crisis we're in, and the first co-carrier referenced the taxpayers. Well, we need more taxpayers in this state to pay for all this wonderful work. And I really do appreciate the cooperation that's went on here, the bipartisan work. Unfortunately, that isn't always the case in every concept that we come up with. If we want to pay for this stuff, a healthcare exchange, the education reforms, and all the good things go with it, if we want to rehire the 250 people that were laid off from my daughter's school district and put them back into the classroom, and we're going to have more taxpayers, not more taxes, more taxpayers. If we want to do all these things, the good care referred to 2014.
To the bill.
I am to the bill, Mr. Speaker. We have to pay for this. If we want to reach the goal of 2014, by 2014, we could have thousands of more taxpayers helping pay for this health care bill right here. This has a fiscal on it. It costs money. Where are we going to get the money? It was referenced. This is about the money. Where does the money come from? You have to have that conversation too. and we're not. We're putting the horse before the cart again, and we are failing the very same people who are going to take advantage of these services we're providing them. Thank you very much.
Further discussion, Representative Greenlink.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill, please.
To the bill.
I first I need to declare a possible conflict of interest.
State your conflict.
I'm a frequent flyer in the healthcare system over the past few years. This bill has the potential to improve the healthcare system for me and others of that class of people that have a potential conflict of interest on this bill.
So noted for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This bill is a very important bill, and it's a stop on a long, slow train ride that began in 1988 with Governor Neil Goldschmidt naming a commission on health care for the uninsured. That commission produced the Oregon Health Plan, House Bill 935 in the 1989 session. When I first got to the legislature in 2003, I got to sit in with the health care committee working on all of a sudden crisis in the Oregon Health Plan. And they traced amigos, then Representative Alan Bass, Representative Ben Westland, Representative Jeff Cruz, began the work to try and bring the Oregon Health Plan back into secure grounds. In 2007, the train stopped again and produced Senate Bill 329, I think is the number, that eventually created the Oregon Health Fund Board. We then, in 2009, did House Bill 2009 that moved us further along the track, and in 2011 did 3650. The ultimate station for this train is a place where every Oregonian has access to affordable, effective, and high-quality health care. This bill does move us along. It's a good bill. The folks who have been working on it have worked very hard on it. I urge you to join me and all the others around the state concerned about this in supporting this bill with a yes vote today. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion, Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. First, I should declare a potential conflict.
State your conflict.
My law firm represents various healthcare practitioners, healthcare businesses that may or may not do business with CCOs being created by this bill.
So noted for the record.
So, colleagues, we've heard a little bit about why this bill should pass, the good things that it does, and the enormous amount of work that's gone into bringing it here today. What I wanted to comment on briefly is a couple of areas where I think it falls short. The first is medical liability reform. We had a chance to address a cost driver in the healthcare system, and we missed it. And it's a shame. We need to be honest with ourselves and leave no stone unturned. There should be no sacred cows, things that we can't address if we are serious about doing a better job of delivering better healthcare at a lower cost. So I think we can hope and rely on the good faith of the governor and future legislatures to address this issue, but this bill doesn't do it. Another weakness, I think, is patient responsibility. I mean, let's be serious with ourselves. We're talking about better healthcare outcomes. How does that work if we don't have any attempt in the bill to involve the patient? There is no provision that deals with patient responsibility. I think that's a miss. What the bill does is it pushes that off. It's a difficult problem, don't get me wrong, but what the bill does is it pushes it off onto the future CCOs. And another concern I have is accountability. The bill does deal with accountability, but it's not very specific. And again, when we're dealing with managed care, the last thing we want, and capitation, the last thing we want is for CCOs to have an incentive not to provide care. We want to bend the cost curve, but we also want better care for Oregon Health Plan patients. So the bottom line is, and I could go on, there are other concerns. The bottom line is there are some risks in this bill There are some risks involved in our passing SB 1580 today, which you would expect in any kind of fundamental reform of a complex, expensive, legally constrained system like the healthcare system. And despite the weaknesses in this bill and the challenges inherent in crafting this kind of legislation, the alternative to do nothing is simply unacceptable. Perhaps the most important lesson I think we could take away from the fact that we are even considering something this complex, this big, and this important to the state of Oregon is that it required leadership to get it here. And I don't mean the twisted, pathetic conception of leadership that values political positioning and partisan gain over good policy. I mean real leadership, to do the hard work that is required to address big issues that matter to Oregonians who are not in this building, to the rest of the state besides us. That kind of leadership demands some risk-taking. So there is risk involved in passing this bill. But I believe, I know, that I was sent here to try to address those kinds of problems, like jobs, and yes, healthcare. I believe we were all sent here to do that. And it is for that reason that despite the risks in the bill, I will be voting yes on SB 1580.
Further discussion, Representative Richardson.
Thank you. Point of order.
State your point.
Mr. Chair, would you rule or explain to us whether there is a need for anyone who happens to be a lawyer that may benefit people that are benefited from this, or you're on a board? I mean, how specific do we need to be for us to declare a conflict of interest?
Thank you for your question. If you look at your sheet, you each have one of these on your desk. It basically says, would you or could you, could the measure affect you financially, number one, either positively or negatively, or affect one of your relatives or businesses in which you or one of your relatives is associated, and does the financial impact affect you or your relative or the business to the same degree as other members of an identifiable group? So if it is a large group and it will affect any of them the same, you do not need to claim a conflict. If it puts a nickel in your pocket, for sure, or takes a nickel out, then you should declare a conflict of interest. Unless you're in a very large group who it puts lots of nickels in lots of pockets, you don't have to declare either. So I hope that makes it clear. If you're a lawyer in general, you don't have to because there's a large, large group. If you have a teacher in your family, you're voting on something that affects a teacher, that's a large group. You don't have to declare a conflict. And the legislature defines the size of the group. We've defined it to be any of those that I've just mentioned. They are really large and don't need to be considered. So hopefully that's a little better. And if people want exact explanations, they can talk to the clerk or they can talk to Representative Richardson or they can talk to myself. Thank you very much. Representative Greenleck, for what purpose?
Chair, I rise to a point of order.
Point of order.
You've just given an explanation. Is that explanation in the House rules?
Mentioned in the House rules, in statute, and is what governs our House rules.
Where in the House rules is it, if I may continue, in the House rules is it mentioned?
If you look on the card, it says it is in 3.20 and referenced in ORS 244.120.1A, 49 Attorney General 167, 1999, issued February, that's an opinion, issued February 24th, 1999.
And that, if I may continue the point of order, does that apply to both a possible conflict of interest and an actual conflict of interest?
Yes, it does.
And that's in 3.20?
Correct. 3.21.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
You're welcome. With that, further discussion, Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I haven't spoken on health care for a while, other than just a comment here and there, because I don't serve on any of those committees, but this is something that started the first year I came to the building in 1989 and worked in the Senate, and I think it was when our current governor was Senate president at that time and imagined the Oregon Health Plan, I think it was Senate Bill 89, and don't quote me on these numbers, I may be wrong, but this is something I've been waiting for a long time. The implementation of a solidly prevention-built, prevention-oriented program. This is a way to deliver our services to people for substantially less money as time goes on, saving more money as time goes on, and actually, as the representative from Beautiful Bend mentioned, I think, about people taking accountability for their health care, because it's designed on a plan that incorporates a kind of a group plan or group approach and keeping people healthy. People will learn better ways to stay healthy, they will learn better ways to keep their families healthy, and eventually that paradigm will change so that they will be relying less and less on emergency department care because they will be taking responsibility in their own families for their health care through nutrition, other diet, exercise, et cetera, and monitoring chronic conditions. And this is, I think this is a good thing, and I think it's a good way to go, and I know it's just for the people on the Oregon Health Plan now, but I look forward to it transferring over to the rest of people in healthcare. I think it's already happening in some sectors. I recently was a patient at OHSU, and my care there was very much like this design, and the food was very healthy, and I got to choose. And I think that it's already happening in some areas, the formation of the CCOs, or talk about it, discussion in groups is happening in my district. And I look forward to this going forward. So please join me in supporting this bill today as a first step forward. And Oregon is being watched all over our country. So let's be a pioneer that we are. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill?
To the bill.
Colleagues, I want to briefly express my concerns with Senate Bill 1580. I am worried that we are legislating to enact an idea or a political philosophy. I don't see a plan, a budget, or a proposal that outlines the details of the implementation. First of all, I have a concern about the lack of provided documentation that the passage of Senate Bill 1518 would result in $500 million from the federal government. No such document could be produced to confirm this transaction. I also was saddened to see that tort reform was not included in the bill language. After having discussions with my doctors, they talk about this being a very important issue where they just assign CAT scans and different things because they don't want to be sued. I was also saddened to see, another concern is what would happen to the $253 million tax dollars in reserves when the existing healthcare entities transform into community care organizations that are already holding money in reserves. What will happen with those tax dollars? Will they disappear as profits? Will they stay in the system? What's going to happen with those dollars? It is my understanding that with Oregon already in a $300 million budget shortfall, the notion of increased responsibility of the Medicaid recipients is staggering. The state of Oregon is expected to enroll over 30,000 people into the program between 2013 and 2017. Between 2013 and 15, we will acquire an estimated 733,522 people on these programs for an average cost of $10,142 per enrollee. At this point, the federal government will assume 95% of the cost, and Oregon will be required to fulfill the remaining 5%. By 2019, the state of Oregon is expected to have enrolled over 955,475 people for a cost per enrollee resting at $12,244 per enrollee at an overall expense of $11.6 billion. With the estimated savings from implementation thus lowering the cost of enrollee down to about $9,118 per enrollee. One could claim that this reduces the cost of overall health care system, but the federal matching drops from 95% to 90%, with the state of Oregon now doubling its expense from 5 to 10%. Furthermore, we know that the plan implementation of the diminishing role of the federal government and their responsibility to help the state pay for the increasing cost will result in continued cost shifting onto the Oregon taxpayer, as outlined in the program. Ultimately, this program will have the state assume full responsibility. Why does this scare me? The current March 2012 general fund budget is only $13.5 billion. $13.5 billion is our current budget. I just don't see how we can generate the massive revenue required to fund even a portion of this program in 5.5 years. We are already cutting vital services to a whole host of government assistance programs. We must ask ourselves, how much will Oregon finally devote to paying for health care? We cannot include the all funds budget with federal matching dollars because the cost shift will become the responsibility of the state, and the percent of the diminishing return each year from the federal government is only speculative after 2020. After 2020, we have no idea how much the state of Oregon will be forced to contribute. Reading from an article from the Heritage Foundation, the CBO initial estimate showed the Medicaid expansion will cost the state just $20 billion, but the addition of just 2 years after implementation increased this number threefold, revealing the crippling effect the expansion will have on the state budget. Colleagues, is what's going to happen is we're going to start cutting our reimbursement rates to doctors. Once those cuts start happening, we're going to start seeing private insurance having to pay more. And cost shifting is something that we've discussed a lot in the healthcare industry and in healthcare committee.
Representative Sheehan yields.
Thank you, Representative. This is something that we need to be concerned with, because either we're going to go to single payer with this, and if that's the intention, we need to explain that and let people know. But the private insurance industry and the middle class is going to be hurt by the passage of this legislation. Businesses are not going to be able to afford to buy insurance for their employees. We need to sit back, take a break. We still have a legislative session coming up in just a few months from now where we can go through this, and we have more time than 1 month rather than meetings with select groups outside of the building where everybody can be updated and put into the process of this. I urge your no vote, and wanted to share a brief explanation why I will be voting no on this bill. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
I will be brief, colleagues. The hour is late and we're all tired. It is not my nature to oppose a bill that has been fully vetted by a lot of people who know a lot more about a subject than I do. So I feel it is incumbent on me to rise and explain why I am unhappy with this bill and cannot support it, because I want to like this. I want to vote yes on this bill. I think all of us understand that in this world there are the devils that we know,
and there are the devils that we don't know. And in this realm of healthcare, I think we've all talked about the devil that we know. It's the silos of money that don't make sense. There's the uneven distribution of services that don't make sense. But most of all, it's the incredible expense that this causes all of us as taxpayers. So when transformation was first suggested, I said, okay, let's take a look at it. And what transformation is to me under this bill, it's the devil we don't know. And I'm frankly a little frightened. I supported it last session. I supported it because it made sense to look at this as a different model, and we were promised savings. I'm big on savings, okay? I admit I was a little skeptical last session, and in fact, I even a few minutes ago described myself as maybe a jaded old lady in this process, and I wanted noted for the record that the representative from Southern Klamath County came right out of his seat when he heard me say that and said, no, no, you're a young woman. Thank you, Representative. But I am and was a little skeptical, and guess what? It was justified. That immediate budget-saving thing didn't exactly happen. So, despite that, we're moving forward full tilt. Friends, I like the idea of this coordinated care organization. I think it has great merit. We have models from it. The carrier mentioned one in his district. There are doctors in my area who have come forward and have a model of developers of this kind of a concept. But I believe this bill, we are stepping out of a sort of a half-tested idea and moving all the way full tilt into uncharted waters. I would suggest that if this is a good idea, we create one CCO. We measure it in terms of its how it works, how much it costs, what it can do against the rest of the healthcare models that we already know. Take the devil we don't know and test it against the devil we already know and see which one works. We, I believe, are creating, by this bill, an immeasurable monster. This proposes to take away the silos, but I think it just replaces it with a hope and a prayer that we're going to save money and it's going to be better. There's, you know, there's transparency and accountability. There are words on the paper. This is a huge thing. My own hospital has been mentioned and suggested that maybe, at the very least, these organizations that we're creating ought to be nonprofits. Why was this rejected? I like private enterprise. You know, I'm big on that. But this is not a competitive business. These are, as I understand it, geographically separated little monopolies that are spending a ton of public dollars. Do you really want that to go into the pockets of private investors? Is that right? But that's in this bill, as far as I'm concerned. You guys, I would like to get here on this bill, but I can't. I know the devil. Healthcare is chaotic and it's grotesquely expensive. This bill, I believe, is a giant leap into the maw of the devil we don't know. And we can't get back out. Once we go, there's no pulling back. Please, I can't support it. I understand that it's going to pass. Hear my cautionary words. This is a very, very dangerous direction to just open the floodgates and see what happens. The devil we know is bad. The devil we don't know could be very much worse. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I want to begin by complimenting the folks that work so hard on this bill and put so much time and effort into it. If there is one area that is of huge importance to all of us, it's healthcare, and I'm so happy to see the Democrats and Republicans working on this issue. I join, however, my colleague from West Salem in saying that this bill is not done. If it was a cake, it's not even out of the bowl yet. If it was a turkey, it's not been plucked yet. This bill isn't ready. And the fact of the matter is it needs to be ready, because what we're really doing is taking a big, huge problem and we're moving it down to a local group of folks to try to figure out. And we're hiding behind two big words, coordination, love that word, I hear it a lot, and local. And those two words are run up the flagpole over and over and over again, and we're told that with those two words, somehow health care will get better. And the truth of it is, I had the privilege for many, many years of representing our local hospital as their attorney, and I had the further privilege of representing many, many doctors. I called a number of them this morning and last night and over the last couple of weeks. In the rural parts of the state, if this is mismanaged, my older group of physicians will quit supplying the care that is so essential to those people that live in the rural parts of the state. That's why it's essential we get this right. And here's what's wrong with the device. What we've done is we've shifted the money to one group and the responsibility, but we haven't given them the power to control two essential elements of healthcare. The first, we haven't been able to control or given them the power to control the demand, and the demand is going to skyrocket. That's a given. The other thing we haven't been able to do is control the folks that are supplying all of that which is necessary for those receiving medical care. In particular, this bill does not address pharmaceuticals. And I have permission to use a visual aid, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Benz requests permission, unanimous consent to use visual aid. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I'm holding up the distribution of the OHP expenditures right here. No, you might not be able to see it as clearly as I can, but there's a great big orange section in the pie chart of expenses. That orange section is pharmaceuticals, 30%. 30% of the current cost is pharmaceuticals. It's not addressed in the CCO control mechanism. It is not. Neither is durable medical equipment, which is another 2%. So what we're doing to the local communities is saying, oh, you can control 68% by paying each other less, but the rest of the challenge is left unaddressed. That is the other 32%. I've heard that this will be discussed later. There isn't time for later. Colleagues, I join all of you in saying we need to do something. I know this is a huge challenge, but it's only going to become more challenging and more difficult as time passes. Let's try to get this first step right. The fear that I heard in the physicians' voices as I talked to them the last couple of weeks was palatable. And their fear actually is not that they won't get paid. Their fear is that there won't be people to help them do all the work. So I'm suggesting let's try to get it right, and I want to say again, I so much appreciate the efforts that folks have made on this bill. I truly do, and I look forward to working with them to try to get it right. Thank you. I too think that it'll probably pass, but we need to send a message saying it's nowhere near to being right. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Kenemer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
You know, I've been listening to this debate, and there's, I think, certainly plenty to be scared of. Frankly, I'm scared. I don't know how in the world CCOs really work. I don't know how you get people to do the right thing, and I'm a living example of middle-aged spread. There are lots of issues in this bill. But I guess the thought that drives me is that where we are is unsustainable. Our current system is simply imploding. That means blowing up. And I think the alternative is to do something. When I sat last year in some of those committee meetings, we began to discuss doing something. Tough issue. It is huge. This is a monster elephant. And this is a piece. I think we're chewing on the leg. I'm not really sure what we're chewing on. But we need to grab a hold of something, and we have to start moving. The system is unsustainable.
I am frightened about the 250,000 more that are coming, but this offers us the potential to begin examining this. Yes, we should have liability insurance. We do not have it. There are lots of pieces that need to be here. It is a complex system. And I fear it's very much like the balloon. When you squeeze it in one location, it pops out in others. But you have to start somewhere. I think this is the best start that we can figure out, and I urge its adoption.
Further discussion? Seeing that no one who has already has not spoken has, I will go to a person for the second time. Representative Schossler.
Thank you for your patience, Mr. Speaker. I know we all want to go. I misspoke earlier in my passion and support for working families to pay for this. I said we're putting the horse before the cart. Well, that's what we're supposed to do, but actually we're putting the cart before the horse. We are looking, when it comes to our land and water and natural resources, we are looking a gift horse in the mouth. But just for you, Mr. Speaker, I will not kick that dead horse anymore today.
Thank you. Further discussion? Seeing none. Representative Freeman, would you like to close?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I got a couple points to go over. So first thing, there's been a little bit of debate about the process. Now, I haven't been here as long as a lot of you, but I've been here as long as some of you and longer than a few of you. This process has been more involved and more open than anything else I have been in. The amount of public meetings, public process, input, decision-making, hearings, everything you can imagine when you think of public process has been done on this bill times 10. And I've been there for a lot of it. And I know a lot of you have been there for all of it. There's very few of us that have been there for all of it. Thank you to all those people that stayed with us and did the public process that's required. To those that don't think this bill's done, I agree. You hear what I said? I agree. It's not done. I wish we could have changed the name transformation to evolution. We will be working on this problem for many, many years. This problem wasn't created in 1 year or one session or with one issue. It will not get solved that way. What I would say to those that say, not now, not this bill, I would ask them, then what? The current system where we have the state telling our communities what to do and what not to do for health care. The current system where just a couple people go into a room downstairs in Ways and Means and set silos of budgets equally across the state without regard for the needs or the ability to deliver those services in different communities of our state. The current system that in every single measurement is financially unsustainable. You have the choice between that system and the beginnings, the evolution of the Oregon Health Care Plan. There was some discussion about some federal numbers and some other stuff that's going on health care. That's not this. This is our health plan. We do lots of great things in the state of Oregon. We grow trees. We've got a wonderful river. I would tell you we have a beautiful city by the river that is proud of being weird. We do some really neat things in the state of Oregon, and we've been innovative. The Oregon Health Care Plan and the way we deliver health care is one of those. This is the evolution of that. There was a discussion about medical liability. I could not agree more with the need to address the cost of defensive medicine, and the other side of that coin, making sure that our patient care is such that we don't have to worry about bad outcomes. There's both sides of that, and this bill requires a legislative concept to come forward. It requires legislators to be on a work group, and it requires providers and an attorney to be on this work group and bring us back solutions that we can live with. Would I have loved to have done more? Yes. There was a discussion about patient responsibility. For those of you that think we are going to mandate and establish patient responsibility laws at this level, I would use one term, and it's a term that's used in end-of-life care, and it's a term that came out of some federal discussion, and that's death panels. We are not going to do that here. Our communities are going to figure out how to engage their local community that has health care needs, and they're going to figure out how best to engage that community to create patient responsibility. This bill not only allows for it, but the previous bill calls for it. And I'm very hopeful that there'll be some both sticks and carrots involved in these local community care organizations to figure out how to best address that particular issue of patient responsibility in their community based upon the needs and the resources they have. Discussion about nonprofits and the current Oregon Healthcare Plan delivery system that we fund today, there is a mixture of for-profit and nonprofits. There are some entities that actually are mixed. There are some government agencies that provide mental health. There are some government agencies that provide mental health and contract with for-profit businesses. It is a wide, varied way to deliver healthcare, and it is my hope our communities get their choice to figure out the best way for them to come together to provide this care. This bill allows for that. Then a couple little discussions about demand. So demand, yeah, there's going to be a lot of demand. The one thing I will tell you, the way you take care of demand for the Oregon Healthcare Plan is you get more people working and less people that qualify for this entitlement social service program. That's what this is. When people work and have jobs and make money, they can buy their own insurance or their employer will provide insurance. And that takes them off the Oregon Healthcare Plan. That's the solution for the demand issue on the Oregon Healthcare Plan. And finally, there was a little bit of talk about the medical part or the medicine part in pharmacy. Clearly, some of the most abusive problems in the medicine portion of this delivery system is the lack of coordination between mental and physical health. And you could throw dental in there too. This system creates a way that these folks can talk to each other and know what each other are prescribing for medicines, so you don't have this siloed approach to dispensing medicines. Now you have a coordinated approach. And I know people may not like the word coordinated, but when it comes to delivering healthcare, we can't divide the person up into silos. They are a one person, and we need to coordinate onto that person to deliver healthcare, and that's what we're attempting to do here. And finally, I want to make sure everybody understands. This is the Oregon Healthcare Plan only. Discussion about OEB, PEB, other things, cost shifting, all those other discussions that have gone on are very valid discussions. Today, we're here to talk about the choice between leaving the Oregon Healthcare Plan like it is today, unsustainable, and quite honestly, tomorrow we won't be able to go vote and balance the budget if we don't pass this bill because it's unsustainable, or moving forward in an incremental step, in an evolution to try to do something better for those that can't buy their own health care. I urge your aye vote on this bill. Thank you.
Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. The clerk will open the voting system. Representative Lindsay, how do you vote? Votes aye. Senate Bill 1580A, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Say it again. Oh. The group that's leaving is from Triangle Lake. Thank you for being here. Hope you had a great time. It took a while to get through the bill. Third reading of Senate bill is done. Other business of the House. Other business of the Senate. Orders of the day have been completed. Announcements. Representative Clem.
Thank you. House Ag and Natural Resource Committee members, we will begin at 1:30. If you're a little late because you're eating your lunch, I'll begin. But get down there as soon as you can after 1:30. Thank you.
Further announcements. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues in the Galleria today is the Oregon Alliance for Golf. Oregon's golf industry generates a total economic impact of over $2 billion. 27,000 jobs of a wage income in the $700 million range. Golf courses provide diverse habitats for a range of wildlife, and Oregon golf courses take their environmental stewardship seriously. Go down and visit these people. Learn more about golf in Oregon. Thank you.
Further announcements, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would just like to thank everybody who was praying for me yesterday, and the text messages and everything that I received. My mother had fallen and broken her neck and her back, but she has movement of all of her hands, her legs and everything, and we don't know what's going to happen, but I appreciate everybody and all of their support.
Further announcements. Remonstrances. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I'd just like to talk to you a little bit about my view of government and how government should function. To me, government should be there to help people when times are bad. We should be saving when everything's good, filling our rainy day fund, and taking advantage of the good economic climates. That way, when we run into downturns like we're facing right now, we have money on the sides to help people. One of the problems I've seen is we're bonding and borrowing when times are good rather than paying for things as we go. And one of the great examples of the way government used to function is the Washington Monument. When they started to build it, they stopped halfway. Why did they stop? Because they ran out of money. Once they had money, they continued building it and they finished the Washington Monument. So as we go forward and we see the economic crisis start to go away and people are going back to work, I urge everybody who's still in this body to start saving and making sure we have money for the next economic downturn, because there always will be a rainy day coming. Thank you.
Further remonstrances. Adjournment. Representative Jensen, 11 a.m. Friday, February 24th, 2012.
Mr. Speaker, I move the House adjourn until 11 a.m. Friday, February 24th, 2012.
Representative Jensen moves the House adjourn until 11 a.m. Friday, February 24th, 2012. Without objection, the House is adjourned.